Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Coming up on the show, Democratic gubernatorial candidate Mary Throne will join us and talk about her plans for the state.
Making ourselves less dependent for state revenue on coal, oil, and natural gas.
Around $30 million will be removed from the Bank of the West following its turn away from fossil fuels. But one city surrounded by oil and gas is not planning to punish its local branch.
As young people move away in greater numbers from Wyoming, a new study shows there might be a trend helping to save some small towns, an influx of Latino families.
They came here and they're liking it and they're starting businesses, they're building homes.
We'll also have a feature on an opera whose theme is locusts. Join us for Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Democrat Mary Throne is hoping to become Wyoming's next governor. Throne was born and raised in Campbell County, growing up on a ranch on Wild Horse Creek. She's currently a Cheyenne attorney and for many years worked with the Department of Environmental Quality. Throne is a former state representative and minority floor leader as well. She's facing Republican opponent Mark Gordon and others in the general election.
I think there are significant differences between Treasurer Gordon and myself. I have run a race emphasizing solutions from the beginning. I'm not afraid to take on what I see as the real challenge in Wyoming, which is making ourselves less dependent for state revenue on coal, oil, and natural gas. That's been my message from the beginning, and it'll continue to be my message into the general election. I've also said that I support full funding for our K-12 system and supporting our constitutional obligation to fund education. I have emphasized the need for real healthcare solutions, including Medicaid expansion, which he does not support. And also have taken a strong stand on keeping public lands in public hands.
Let's talk about how we move the state forward and how we create jobs and maybe get some more revenue in here without the T word. Can we avoid taxes or does that need to be part of the mix?
Well, Governor Mead and now the Endow Report and people like the chairman of the Revenue Committee, Mike Madden, and myself have all said that we need to reform our tax structure. You know, we can't build the economy of the future based on the tax structure of the past. I'm a strong supporter of the energy industry, as you know, but we can't expect them to pay all of our bills going forward.
As best you can, when you talk about reform, and God knows I tried to ask some Republicans about this a number of times, but explain what you're after. What do you think would work? And is it, because every time I ask a question like this, a lot of the answers I get with, well, we're not going to raise taxes. And I'm not sure that's exactly what you're talking about. It's more about reform, isn't it?
Well, and it's also about broadening the tax base, finding more revenues. One tax that I do support is some sort of leisure tax to help fund our tourism industry. The industry itself is still working out the details on what they can support, but you know that's low-hanging fruit and would get more money out of our tourism industry, which is our second leading industry. And a lot of that would be paid by people from out of state. So it's silly not to tap into that revenue. We can bite the bullet and look at exemptions. But we also just need to start the process now for developing a new tax structure. Both Representative Kirkbride and Senator Rothfuss had tax reform 2020 bills. You put the two of them together and you've pretty much got the principles that you need in an equitable, fair, competitive tax system. And we just need to have a discussion on what we want for Wyoming.
And the thinking is that there are some that aren't really paying anything.
Right. Again, the REMI study from the Revenue Committee, demonstrates that we can diversify the economy, we can bring new business into Wyoming, and we still won't get ahead because of our tax structure.
Mary Throne visiting with us. She's a Democratic candidate trying to be your next governor in the state of Wyoming. You mentioned Endow, and you've had a chance to see their latest version of the report. I'm curious what you think about what you're seeing so far. Is there anything missing? Is there anything you don't support?
Well, the key to Endow is the action plan, which we won't have for a few months. The intermediate steps. There are pieces of it I like, pieces of it I'm still digesting. I don't know that new cabinet officials is exactly where we need to go. I'm a little skeptical of those sorts of things, but the concepts and the principles are good, that we need to develop new industries, focus on key sectors. Some of their points I think are too aspirational. I think we need early childhood today, not 20 years from now.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about that, explain what you mean. So making sure that we have affordable childcare and early childhood education at the same time.
Right. Now we have sort of nothing formal and a hodgepodge of early childhood education across the state. And study after study tells us that that would save us money in the long run, in our K-12 costs.
I mean, you were in the legislature when they voted this down at least once. I'm curious what it would take to maybe get everybody to buy in on this.
Well, if we could set the politics aside and set aside the phony arguments that it's anti-family, different things like that, I think would really help.
Mary Throne visiting with us again. Let's change gears. I want to ask you about a couple of other things that are constantly coming up. And one of these is in the social issue arena, calls by some folks for let's get an anti-discrimination bill out there. Let's pass it. How important is that, do you think?
I think it's very important, and that was also supported by Endow. It's how we welcome new business here. It's how we show that we're an open state. It will also help attract the younger demographic that we so desperately need. I was pretty horrified with what happened at Eastern Wyoming College when the state party chair goes to a duly elected independent board and, for all practical purposes, threatens them if they adopt policies. We can't have that in Wyoming.
I want to also ask you, as we talk about different issues, I mean, what about in education? Are there reforms that need to be done in K-12, or are we happy with where we're at and it's just a matter of funding? I'm kind of curious your thoughts there.
Well, we have to look at the things that are not going well. We still have to try and improve our graduation rates. I don't think anybody's happy that the ACT scores dipped. We need to dig into that. But we also need to honestly tell the public that to maintain the small class size and maintain quality teachers is going to cost us money because, you know, the next cuts will get into the way into the muscle.
Is it time to consolidate school districts?
You know, I think I would like to encourage school districts, the smaller school districts around the state. You know, the Bighorn Basin has multiple districts. Southwest Wyoming has multiple districts, and they're not very far apart. I certainly would like to encourage them to consider consolidation if we do it as a top-down threat from Cheyenne. I don't think that's the way to go. Mm-hmm. But I also think that while it's important to save money where you can, that's going to save us maybe tens of millions. That doesn't solve our fundamental educational funding program.
But it might actually help education. I guess the way I've looked at this over the years in reporting on it is you've got some of these school districts, it's hard to get somebody that can teach French,
right,
or it's hard to get some of these teachers.
Right.
And if you all just combine resources, you might be able to address that, and then you'd think that it would improve education.
No, and I think that that's something you could even do without consolidating districts. For instance, I know in Rock Springs, when their high school was crowded, people would go to Green River. Mm-hmm. You know, you can do those sorts of things now, and certainly we would want to encourage districts to take advantage of those options. You know, if you have two people who want to take calculus and there's a class down the road, 10 miles, where they have 10 people. It makes a lot of sense to put everybody together.
Well, I recently came from a committee meeting talking about the opioid situation, and I was curious your thoughts on that. I mean, what I'm hearing from this particular group is you want to do a lot of education, and we want to put a lot of rules in place also for healthcare providers. Are you following that at all? And I'm just curious your thoughts on dealing with that.
I think we need to make sure that in Wyoming we have the best practices in place. I've heard that we do not have an opioid problem on the same scale that other states have. And of course, we'd like to prevent that from happening. So I'm willing to consider appropriate regulations on prescriptions and pharmacists and providers, you know, without being too heavy-handed. I know that I've had friends whose children died or child died of an overdose. And that's really one of the key issues. But another key issue is the substance abuse treatment aspect, which applies to more than just opioids. We need to have cost-effective programs in place for substance abuse treatment.
Not only for opioids, but for all kinds of things.
For everything.
Yeah. And also, when we talk about this, you mentioned Medicaid expansion earlier. I mean, Medicaid in just finally getting our arms around this seems to be a really important thing. If not Medicaid expansion, what are we going to do with this population?
Well, that's my question to all the people who oppose Medicaid expansion. We don't have an answer. We could spend a lot of state dollars, I suppose, and get health care to this population. But that doesn't make a lot of sense. We didn't do that during the boom times. We have a good Medicaid program in the state. Our expansion population could fit into that. It would be cost effective. And it would be paid for by the federal government. At this rate, I think we're close to the 90-10 ratio. That is still a fantastic deal for the state of Wyoming. And it avoids cost shifting to the rest of us. And should over time help stabilize our insurance rates, which is a huge issue in Wyoming.
Last thing for you, and we'll certainly talk with you more down the road, but we're seeing a lot of deregulation, obviously, coming from Washington. And one of the things that could happen is an area that you know an awful lot about, and that's the environment and natural resources. And it seems that if things go as planned, the EPA would have less authority over a number of these things in our state and give more to the DEQ. Could the state of Wyoming handle that?
Well, I think in the past, the state of Wyoming did handle it. The core principle in the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, most of those environmental acts is a concept called cooperative federalism, which means the federal government sets the standards that need to be met for human health, and then the states implement them based on their own needs. And I think one of the big complaints with the last administration was that they forgot that concept, and they were a little heavy-handed with the states. So I believe the state of Wyoming is in a strong position to basically fulfill its role under those organic environmental statutes.
Mary Throne, she's a Democratic candidate for governor. We're out of time. It went quickly. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks, Bob. I always enjoy talking to you.
Wyoming is seeing an influx of Latinos around the state. We'll have that coming up on Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. It's painful to watch the small town you love shrink as the young people move to bigger cities in search of jobs and a more urban lifestyle. But in Wyoming and around the West, some towns that would be shuttering are actually starting to see a resurgence of young families moving in, young Latino families. As Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports, that kind of growth is really happening in Rawlins.
Rawlins City Councilor and former mayor Debari Martinez gives me a tour around town in his truck. He points out all the Latino-owned businesses we pass: a flower shop, a photographer's studio, a steakhouse.
They're closed today, but he's a Latino. That's a detail shop.
This guy here, his name's Lujan.
DeBarry says Rollins has about 17 Latino-owned businesses now and more to come. He says it's nothing new, though. He sits on the local museum board and says Latinos homesteaded here at the same time that whites did.
They started out with the lumber industry, and when it fell apart, they ended up in the sheep industry.
After sheep, jobs opened up in the railroad, the penitentiary, and at the Sinclair Refinery. That's where DeBarry spent 40 years of his career. Now the refinery is expanding and recently hired hundreds more workers. He says Latinos are more willing to take such jobs than white workers and more willing to stay.
They're going to make their home here. The wages, you wouldn't believe it. I mean, if you got out of high school, you can make $90,000 in a year.
Those kinds of living wages have prompted a growth spurt in minority populations in rural towns across the West, and especially in Wyoming. That's according to a new study by Headwaters Economics, a research firm that studies community development issues.
So because of people of color moving into a community, these places are kind of in some ways being kept afloat.
Economist Megan Lawson says six counties in Wyoming would have lost total population if it wasn't for minority groups settling there. In Rollins, a quarter of the population is from a minority group. And in Carbon County, where Rollins sits, it's even more, almost a third of the population. Small towns in Wyoming's eastern and northern plains are also seeing the same population bump because white workers have vacated many farming jobs in those regions.
You know, the challenge of dryland farming in the high plains, kind of those boom-bust agricultural cycles.
In small towns around the West, minorities clean hotel rooms, build new homes, and serve as nurses to tend the elderly who've been left behind.
Folks moving in are keeping schools open, they're keeping grocery stores, you know, solvent, and those kinds of day-to-day things that really sustain a place.
Josh Martinez is the assistant director of the Rollins Chamber of Commerce, and his family came here for the railroad and the sheep in the 1890s. He says he remembers how divided the town used to be.
It's kind of the way it was growing up, though, is the south side of Rollins was the Mexican side.
But Josh grew up on the north side, a sign of how integrated the community has become. He says that, coupled with Rollins' rich Latino history, has made it more welcoming for families arriving from Texas and Mexico. But he says they also moved to Rollins for the same reason anyone might, for the wide open spaces.
Us as a culture, you know, we're a very outdoorsy type of group, and it's very natural for us to want to be around nature.
My kids love it. We go out and camp, fishing. Yeah. You know, we spend the weekend there. We have fun. We go out and hang out with friends. It's amazing.
That's entrepreneur Katrina Molina, who just opened an interior decorating store in downtown Rollins.
Flooring and cabinets. That's what we do.
Molina grew up in Mexico and moved to Denver when she was 16.
It was kind of scary, kind of emotional, because you have to give up your other citizenship.
Her husband found work in Rollins building homes about 10 years ago, and then recently they bought the interior decorating business.
It just fits. So yeah. We decided to buy it and give it a try.
And how's it been going?
It's been going really, really good.
So good, in fact, that they bought a house in Sinclair, then another in Rollins that they're remodeling. She says she feels comfortable raising her kids in Rollins because there's lots of people who share their language and culture. But she says lately a few of those friends have been moving back to Mexico.
I know some people that left actually when the president was elected because they were afraid of what was going to happen. So people are scared. They are.
At the end of our tour, City Councilor DeBarry Martinez drives to the city park and climbs out. He says he's worried that the recent rise in anti-immigrant sentiment in the country could slow down his town's growth. So he decided to get proactive. This year, he threw a Latino festival here with food trucks, a live band.
It was full. It was all the way back there, and there was people yelling and screaming. The hard part was trying to dance.
DeBarry says he plans to host a Latino festival in Rollins every year from now on. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
We'll be right back.
The president and the Interior Department are calling for more timber harvesting to help ease wildfires. But as the American West deals with mega fires and bad smoke, we wanted to know if that works. So we looked to the Canadian province of British Columbia. It chops down more than three times as many trees as all the western U.S. combined. So we sent Nate Hedgie up there to spend some time with a seasoned fire ecologist. And spoiler alert, logging is not a silver bullet.
The sun is just a dim red dot. The nearby Canadian Rockies are shrouded in thick wildfire smoke, and Bob Gray knows we probably shouldn't be hiking up a mountain right now.
I have a scratchy throat. Physically, it affects my breathing. I probably shouldn't spend a lot of time in it, although I have over a 30-year career.
A career as a fire ecologist. Gray is a fast hiker with dark wavy hair and a young face, a self-described glass-half-empty kind of guy, a worrier. And as an eerie wind begins to blow, he glances at the rows of charred, teetering dead pines all around us.
Yeah, a little bit worried about that wind?
Yeah, just a little bit. I don't want to get trapped in here. There's no cell coverage.
This mountain burned last year, and before that, it was harvested, which is an industry word for logging. British Columbia is one of the biggest softwood lumber producers in the world. In fact, many U.S. houses are built using pine trees harvested from these forests. But in recent years, massive, unprecedented wildfires have swept across the province, just like the one that ran through this patch of logged land.
This is an area that was partially harvested, and the fire didn't stop here. It burnt just as hot here as it did in the places that hadn't been harvested.
Gray says traditional logging hasn't really eased wildfires in British Columbia because the industry takes the wrong kind of trees. Well, the trees that are great for lumber. But it's the millions of sickly, dead, and skinny trees that help lay the groundwork for big fire. Those are the ones that overcrowd a forest, dry out during the summer, and then turn into kindling. Gray says many British Columbia timber companies can't squeeze a buck out of all those crappy trees and brush, so they don't harvest them. And that's created a problem.
We kind of gut-shot the landscape. I mean, we went out and we cherry-picked the best stands, and we left them full of slash.
That's the woody debris left over from logging.
And then in between the cut blocks, we left just patches of dead trees.
But the British Columbia government says logging can ease wildfires if companies take steps to mitigate wildfire risk, like burning slash after they log. How often that happens depends on who you talk to, but Gray is convinced most companies don't. In a report sent to the BC government last year, Gray and other fire ecologists said logging also decreased forest diversity because companies replanted the same trees over and over. That's contributed to unhealthy, more fire-prone forests. That said, Gray doesn't blame the logging industry for the current crisis in BC. He says climate change, a bark beetle epidemic, and decades of poor forest management are all much bigger drivers. Besides, he says it's not the industry's job to ease wildfire.
They log to make money. They don't log to solve a social problem.
And here's a hard truth. That social problem isn't going away. See, forests need fire like people need sex. Sure, wildfires can be hot and dangerous for us humans, but it's necessary for the health and reproduction of the forest. But over the past century, we've suppressed those fires because more and more people are moving out here and we don't want our homes burned down. Gray says that's created a problem that won't be solved in our lifetime. Sorry. But the mega fires and smoky summers are here to stay.
That's a really hard concept for people to... You mean we can't fix it? No, unfortunately we can't.
As we walk through the charred forest in British Columbia, Gray says if we trim back those skinny weak trees, do more prescribed burns, and drastically reduce carbon emissions now, there's a chance we could eventually ease wildfires for future generations. I test his optimism.
Do you think we're going to do it? Do you think that we'll be able to solve this crisis for our kids and grandkids?
You seriously want me to answer that?
Of course I do.
I really hope that we rise to the occasion and we do what's best for future generations.
That was a good bit of optimism right there. Well, what do you think's going to happen though?
Well, I don't think we're going to get there. I really think that we're greedy. So realistically, no. I don't think we're going to get there.
We can hope.
We can hope.
For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie in Cranbrook, British Columbia, Canada.
Coming up, a Wyoming community is sticking with Bank of the West and a discussion about wind energy. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Counties and cities across Wyoming are removing funds from Bank of the West following a statement that it will no longer finance any coal, oil, or gas activities unless it's clean energy focused. The amount divested is already totaling in the tens of millions, but one city has definitively said that it wants to keep its funds right where they are, in Rawlins, a city surrounded by oil and gas. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim has the story.
All right, next item on the agenda is a resolution to remove municipal funds from Bank of the West.
Recently, the city of Rawlins took a concrete stance no city or county in Wyoming yet has. And it might sound odd. Its city council voted to not remove funds from Bank of the West.
Closing, and the motion fails with 5 votes in nay, Mayor Grauberger, yay.
It's a controversial decision because in August, Bank of the West decided to stop financing, distributing, or marketing all activities within coal, oil, or gas, unless it focuses on clean energy.
I would say it struck a nerve in a lot of us.
That's Bruce Hinchey, president of the Petroleum Association of Wyoming. The decision from Bank of the West also struck a nerve with Wyoming leaders. U.S. Senator John Barrasso called the decision an attack on Wyoming families that depend on fossil fuels. Governor Matt Mead, gubernatorial candidate and state treasurer Mark Gordon, and several state legislators also criticized the decision. And she says he agrees, because for him, minerals have given so much to the state.
Our kids are in school that belong to the parents that work in the industry, and welders, and you name it. I mean, it just goes on and on. Geologists, engineers.
So Hinchey says he would like to see everyone in Wyoming remove their money from the bank.
I think it makes a statement if we can do that, just like they made their own statement.
Already, 2 counties have committed to divesting funds, along with 2 cities and a sheriff's department. The amount to be removed already totals around $30 million.
You're not teaching a bank that makes more money than your entire state a lesson by taking money out of a bank.
That's Rawlins Vice Mayor Steve Sanger. The bank's assets total nearly $90 billion. A vote to remove funds from Bank of the West came in front of the Rawlins City Council, and Sanger voted against it. The resolution failed. Sanger says he voted to keep funds with the bank for several reasons. First, it wasn't the Rawlins local branch or any other in Wyoming that decided to turn away from fossil fuels. It was their parent company, BNP Paribas, the 8th largest bank in the world.
I don't see any reason why I should penalize them for the good work that they've done here.
And Sanger says it's not as if mineral companies in the area were relying on the bank to fund operations either.
The money was there to make local lending decisions, not invest in 1,500 wells in the Atlantic Rim.
No oil or gas company in the area attested to having funds from the bank. And of the many companies contacted for this story, few cared about Rawlins City Council's or the Bank of the West decisions. One company with 2 wells in Carbon County didn't have any strong opinion. A Coal Insider says Bank of the West's commitment won't amount to much. Only one oil and gas company explicitly disavowed the bank's move and hoped to see further divestment. University of Wyoming professor of petroleum and natural gas economics Chuck Mason says the apathy may be because mineral companies in Wyoming likely won't be affected by the bank's decision. Large oil, gas, and coal companies rely on much bigger financing institutions.
I very much doubt that Alpha Coal would need to get its funding from Bank of the West. They'll find somebody else, probably a venture capital.
Mason says that if Bank of the West won't feel the loss of Wyoming's funds and the mineral companies won't be affected, the around $30 million already committed to divest from local banks will mainly function as a statement.
There's a kind of an awful lot of posturing here that, to my mind, doesn't really amount to much.
In an email, a representative from Bank of the West responded, its move away from fossil fuels has been a long-term commitment. Its parent company stopped financing coal-fired power plants back in 2015 and committed to move away from fracking and tar sands in 2017. But it wasn't until this past August's press release that Wyoming leaders took issue with the stance. Rawlins Bank of the West branch manager Nate Davidson gets it, though. Back at the Rawlins City Council meeting, he said its message was misconstrued and seemed negative.
If you put out negative, you're probably going to get negative in return.
Several more counties and cities are considering removing funds from Bank of the West. Laramie County is likely to remove $16 million in funds from the bank, Albany County Treasurer Linda Simpson says representatives from the bank will speak to the Wyoming Association of County Officers at the end of September. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Wyoming has big potential in wind energy, but conservation biologists warn we need to pay attention to how wind turbines can be harmful to wildlife. Biologists are trying to be ahead of the game by figuring out ways to protect wildlife while still producing wind energy. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska spoke with Holly Copeland, the Director of Science for the Nature Conservancy in Wyoming, on what animals are in danger.
As a conservation biologist, we're really concerned about especially birds and bats. So both birds and bats have issues with wind turbines. There have been a number of studies looking at the problem between conflicts between birds and bats. And for example, a study that was done in 2013 found that there were over 500,000 birds that were lost to wind turbines and almost 1 million bats.
And so does this mean that they just run or fly into the wind turbine and then get killed right away?
Pretty much, yeah. In different ways, bats, my understanding is they fly in a little bit differently but than eagles do, for example, but the net result is that they collide with the turbines.
And so how can we deal with this?
The most important thing we could do would be to site our wind turbine developments away from habitats that eagles and bats, for example, are using. So we would identify where the most important nesting habitat for eagles was, or areas that were important for bats. Bats in particular are tree roosting bats, or the types of bat species that have the highest conflict with wind turbines. So developments, for example, that are near forests would be a high likelihood to have conflict with bats, with tree roosting bats. So if we can site those wind facilities away from important areas for birds and bats, particularly in most more disturbed habitats, if we can put them in places where we already have seen a lot of human impact from maybe other types of energy use like oil and gas fields or coal fields or agricultural fields, we still might have some bird conflicts, but we would expect to have fewer because our native habitats, they've already kind of selected away from those habitats.
Is this something that you're working on and trying to find where these places are in Wyoming?
We are working on this. So we are working with biologists around the state to map important areas for eagles, for example, for bats, for other grassland bird species like sage thrasher and sage sparrow and brewer sparrow. And we're putting those maps together as a resource, and then they're all being compiled in a database that will then be served up and available to wind developers so they can look at these maps and hopefully cite, you know, choose away from those important areas of bird migration habitat, for example.
Are we worried about any other type of wildlife, like any migration corridors or anything else?
Yeah, you know, they're one of the areas right now that's of concern in the Shirley Basin is one of the central areas where there are a number of proposed projects. And the Shirley Basin is also home to some of our largest pronghorn populations in the state. And so it is unknown at this point the degree to which wind turbines would conflict with migrating pronghorn, for example. And that's something my colleague Matt Kaufman at the Wyoming Migration Initiative just launched a new study just to look at that specifically. And we're contributing to help fund that study so that we understand before a turbine goes in, before this planned project goes in, we can look at the before and after and see what the likely impacts of that could be on pronghorn.
What's at stake? Why is this important? Why should we care about this?
Wyomingites have a real love and appreciation of the state's wildlife. Our pronghorn, our ungulate populations, our bird populations. We have a deep love of that resource. And if we want to see them persist into the future, both for appreciation, for hunting resource, for tourism, for all the things that draw people to come here and to live here, then we have to safeguard those populations into the future. And we have to be very conscious as we plan forward for these types of development that there could be some real big impacts to our wildlife populations. So we need to carefully plan for that development. And so we're just really trying to get on the leading edge of that planning and help people understand what the potential conflicts could be so that we can all engage in this conversation in a public way, in a very informed way, to ensure that we have this amazing wildlife resource for many, many years to come.
And what would happen if we don't pay attention to this? What's the worst outcome?
I guess the worst outcome is we lose golden eagle populations in the state. We, you know, maybe there are some remnant populations around, but we effectively have really crippled those populations. So they're far fewer than they are today. That we, you know, segment our pronghorn populations into tiny dispersed populations that are, you know, can't do the migrations that they have done for thousands and thousands of years. So that resource isn't there for hunters. It's not there for photographers.
Holly Copland, Director of Science for the Nature Conservancy in Wyoming. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
When we come back, we'll have a discussion with the chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, and we'll hear about an opera about locusts. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. The chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, or NEH, visited northern Wyoming this week. Chairman John Parrish Peedy spoke with Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kadelska on the power of humanities and art to push back ignorance. He says during his tenure as chairman, he hopes he can help everyday America realize the power of humanities.
Each chairmanship, you have something you focus on more than others. So, for example, I'm from Mississippi. I graduated in a class of 29 people. Somebody gave me the yearbook recently. And that American experience, I think, is not unlike others here in Wyoming. It's not unlike others across the South, the Midwest. And they feel that same sense that that they have a history and a life that is somewhat separate from the national narrative. And so I probably do lean into that. There are those who maybe feel that we're a large agency in Washington, D.C., they wouldn't even think of applying for funding for us, for example. And one of my jobs is to say, you're welcome. This is your agency. We exist for you. And we're investing in your community. And I never want them to feel that there's a barrier.
So you brought up what I was going to mention next, is that you grew up in a small town in Mississippi. So what was your exposure to humanities in such a small kind of rural area?
I was fortunate that it was a small town, but it was outside the capital city. It was a rich cultural, artistic community in a state that otherwise was last in ranks of education and poverty and other issues. And I thought that I wanted to learn my state's culture. I didn't want just the larger narrative to be defined outside of my community. And I think that's important. I spent a lot of time in the West, particularly with Native American tribes. And for example, a lot of those conversations are very similar, that we don't just want the outsiders to define who we are in our culture and our place. So for me then, in that small town, and this was pre-internet, and I think people who live in rural America that have broadband access or internet access have some opportunities we didn't have then, but books were available. So I do think it's important to avail us of those resources. And at the federal level, I need to make sure our agency is playing a role in access.
And recently, it seems that humanities is enclosed within university walls. And so what is the role of public humanities outside of these campus walls?
I think for the humanities to not only survive, but to be meaningful, that the humanities have to thrive outside of the walls of campus. So I think that means programming at libraries. I think it means programming at cultural centers. I think we shouldn't think of our museums, even our best ones, as just a place where the public comes in and absorbs something that we've already curated. But it means lectures. It means film nights. And so I think it's allowing these points of intersection, for example.
And so is it also kind of maybe changing people's minds of what humanities is about, like the power of humanities?
Absolutely. So, for example, when Google identified either 6 or 7 characteristics that they thought they wanted in their employees and their leaders, and either 5 of 6 or 6 of 7, whichever it was, were core humanities activities. These were critical reasoning skills. This was a capacity to process information, to organize it. It was evidence-based decision-making, things of this nature. All of those are either absolutely direct objectives in the humanities studies, or they're byproducts of having a humanities mindset. And so if you talk to employers, the humanities are not a frivolous matter. It is about having a well-shaped employee, a well-shaped manager. And so part of talking about in society about the humanities is we shouldn't just say it's aesthetically important that you'll be a better person. You know, this is so abstract. I think what we need to talk about is, yes, those happen to be facts too, but that really, in many ways, we're in a bifurcated country. And if you want an engaged citizenship, then those engaged citizens are participating in the arts and humanities as audience members, as participants, direct participants, as patrons. And you have to take steps, concrete steps, to incubate these activities. And so to support your libraries, to have convening spaces outside of the universities, for example.
And do you think this power of humanities has been lost?
Well, I think it's more diffuse. So I think some things a generation or two ago that we took for granted, that it was a matter of principle, that of course you would know about the framers of the Constitution, about the founders' Declaration of Independence, that you would have pride in this, that it would be a given that you had this level of awareness, frankly, just to be an engaged citizen. I think we have lost that. And I think that's only going to be addressed and resolved neighborhood by neighborhood, community by community, state by state. And the humanities say that, yes, we want to be free, and here's what freedom has been, and here's how it's been obtained, and that the humanities exist to push back against ignorance in all its forms. And the humanities are inseparable, it seems to me, from being in a state of civilization. And I think we're a long way from living in a civilization that is lacks in freedom and dwells in ignorance. But you do need people to stand up and say, this is of value. This is indeed not a value only, but it is essential.
So from what I'm understanding, it's very important not to forget, as a national organization, as a federal organization, not to forget about the local and about the communities that it kind of are telling the stories of our nation.
Absolutely. If you think of building a house, a skyscraper, the states are the foundation, they're the base. We want the Empire State Building. We don't get there unless we have strong cornerstones, if we have a strong foundation.
I'm here joined with John Parrish Petey, the chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me on. Thank you.
two professors from the University of Wyoming have created an original opera about the story of an unusual subject, the Rocky Mountain locust. The show will premiere at the end of the month in Jackson. Wyoming Public Radio's London Homer Wambeam has more.
If you lived in Wyoming in the late 1800s, you would recognize this sound. This is the sound of millions of locusts blackening the sky. What you hear is a recreation of a locust swarm from the 2007 film, The Reaping. These insects look a lot like grasshoppers, and they are very, very hungry.
Congress in the 1800s called the Rocky Mountain locust the greatest impediment to the settlement of the western United States.
That's Dr. Jeff Lockwood, who studied locusts for years as an insect ecologist at the University of Wyoming. He says that the Rocky Mountain locust would decimate crops, leading to famine and huge economic setbacks for farmers. But in 1877, the Rocky Mountain locust vanished, something that remains a mystery. The reason Lockwood chose the topic is because the story about vanishing locusts is dramatic and literally biblical. The composer is Dr. Ann Guzzo, a fellow professor at the University of Wyoming. Guzzo admits an opera about locusts might not work.
I'm not sure it does, actually, and that's part of the attraction. An absurd opera with a locust as a main character allows you to sort of tell allegorical tales in ways that maybe if I just had an actual scientist saying nothing but the science wouldn't be as effective.
Lockwood wrote the libretto, or the lyrics for the opera, basing it on a book he wrote about the subject. He worked closely with Guzzo while she composed music for his words. They've worked together before during the U-Cross pollination experiment, a 2014 project that brought together scientists and artists. In many ways, Locust the Opera is a continuation of that experiment. Once they had the opera written, the next piece that Guzzo and Lockwood needed was a conductor, Thomas Blomstar. His role is to keep everyone on track.
I want to do my best to be really honest to what Annie wrote. The training of classical musicians especially is one that encourages poetic license. And I'm a real, nasty cop about that stuff.
Blomstar has a personal connection to the Rocky Mountain locust. His great-grandfather settled in South Dakota in the late 1800s and survived locust swarms.
And so I certainly heard about that from my grandfather and from my uncle, who's still on the family farm.
Next, the production needed a soprano to play the locust. Blomstar and Guzzo had worked with professional soprano Kristen Colvin in the past, and they knew she was open to experimental concepts.
So they contacted me and they said, "We have this project we think you would be interested in." And I said, "Yes."
Colvin became much more than the soprano, though, and filled the role of stage director. Colvin says the opera uses absurdity and dream logic to convey more complex ideas.
When you cross over that permeable land into dreams, you have opportunities to envision the world in a different way. You can see creatures that don't necessarily fit the laws of physics, and you can really play with that.
In the story, Colvin plays the ghost of the Rocky Mountain locust. She has a dialogue with two other characters, a farmer and a scientist. The farmer and scientist have very different relationships with the ghost of the locust. For the scientist, the locust is a muse and a mystery as he tries to discover the cause of its extinction. For the farmer, the locust threatens his survival. It's difficult to capture the scale of a locust swarm with a small chamber opera, so Lockwood says the opera will also have audience participation.
The audience will be equipped with sheets of cellophane. And then using a certain code that the conductor will teach them, they will make the sound of a swarm passing through the auditorium.
Composer Ann Guzzo adds,
"I'm sure you've gone to a show where you were mad that someone was wrinkling the paper, and now we're actually asking you to wrinkle your program."
All the people involved in Locust the Opera are excited to be working on something original and experimental, which Blomstar says is a rarity in opera.
Especially in the realm of classical music, like if you play in a symphony orchestra professionally for a while, you see the same damn pieces every 3 years. It's like on a rotation.
The team hopes to tour Locust the Opera around the world. It will premiere in Jackson at the National Museum of Wildlife Art September 28th and 29th. One planned show is in Morocco at a conference for ornithopterologists. That's people who study grasshoppers, crickets, and locusts. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm London Homer Wambim.
That's our program for today. Remember that Wyoming news coverage is not free. We need your support to keep producing programs like Open Spaces each and every week. To support our Wyoming news coverage, click on the pledge button at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
And while you're there, you can check out this show, any of the individual segments, or past programs. You can also check out our podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.